welcome to this week's Yes to Life show. I'm particularly excited about the guests and content of this week's show, which is a bit of a departure from the general subject matter we cover. I've been carefully watching the development of an entirely new concept for delivering healthcare to people with chronic conditions within the NHS for more than 5 years. The reason I'm so interested in this development is that it is the first genuine manifestation of two key tenets of government policy that we've been hearing about for decades: choice and patient-centred care. The acronym for this scheme is PHB, which stands for Personal Health Budget. And be warned, we're entering acronym territory in today's show, as you can't get far in the NHS without getting your head around a slew of acronyms that trip effortlessly off the tongues of NHS staff. To give you a preview of a few that you'll hear today, apart from PHBs, you'll hear of CCGs, which are clinical commissioning groups, the recently formed alternative to PCTs, primary care trusts, and formed of groups of GPs who now have the power to commission care services. You'll also hear about IBC, which stands for Integrated Personal Commissioning, which is a more recent development that's enabling people to receive seamless support from both healthcare and social services without the horse trading that has characterised working with these two separate services in the past. The public is, I think, largely unaware of PHBs, of how radical they are, and of government plans to roll out large numbers of them in the coming years. Up to now, no one with cancer has received one, but the conditions are approaching where this may become possible, hence my interest. The main part of the show today is given over to talking to the man at the top. James Sanderson is Head of Personalisation for NHS England and responsible for the development and delivery of personal healthcare in England. I went to meet him at the NHS offices in Skipton House, Southwark.
James, thanks very much indeed for coming to talk to us on the Yes to Life show about personal health budgets.
No problems. Good afternoon. Pleasure.
So I've been following the developments of personal health budgets for over 5 years now, and I would describe them as the biggest single development in the NHS since it started. That's my personal take. But how important do you think that PHBs are going to turn out to be in the development of healthcare in the long run?
Well, personal health budgets and personalised care, incredibly important to the future sustainability of the NHS, and also the future in relation to the way in which we provide person-centred care and support to individuals within the system. You know, the NHS next year is 70 years old, a fantastic institution, born on some amazing principles, sort of free at the point of need, and a service that's a universal service for all. And the NHS does some fantastic work across a range of specialisms and a range of services. But actually for many people, that approach sometimes doesn't meet their individual needs, the specific complications that they live with in life. And that's where a personalised approach to health and care and also well-being comes in. And personal health budgets are a key tool in actually enabling services to be centred around the needs of an individual, tailored to their specific requirements, and actually enable them to be empowered to take more control over their health and well-being. And we think that they're incredibly important for the way in which the NHS works in the future.
So I want to get into the nitty-gritty of how they work and everything as we go on. So personalisation, as you called it, has a long history. You know, MPs, they started talking about patient choice, patient-centred care at least 40 years ago, as far as I'm aware, but it's proved extremely hard to implement. There's been plenty of activity under the banner of personalisation, but I think it's fair to say that PHBs are the first real manifestation of personalisation that's having a significant impact on patients. You want to give us a brief overview of how personalisation has developed?
Yes, well, I mean, as you say, there's a long history in terms of people wanting more choice and control over the services that they receive. And really, I think the start of the disability movement in the 70s and 80s, where people, you know, called for more choice and control, the movement that cried for nothing about us, without us, led to young people, young disabled people in institutionalised care saying we wanted to live independently, we want to have choice and control over our care provision. And I think that really started a bit of a personalisation revolution actually in the 80s, and that led to the creation of the Independent Living Fund, which was formed in 1988, which was the first time that people received cash instead of care provision, and that cash enabled them to structure care packages around their needs. And lots of developments then through the 90s, which led to direct payment legislation in 1997, with the Direct Payments Act being introduced, where for the first time local authorities were able to provide cash payments to individuals in the form of personal budgets. But it then probably took about 10 years for that to take an effect. And now in adult social care, we see around 500,000 people receiving their care and support through a personal budget. And health has looked at that model, and in 2008 it was decided to launch some pilots to trial personal budgets in health that mirrored what was going on in social care. So there are a number of pilots that were run for personal health budgets between 2009 and 2012, and those pilots demonstrated that when people were put in the centre of the care assessment, when people were given choice and control over their care provision, it found that that group of people tended to have improved health and well-being outcomes, and the cost of their care and support tended to reduce. So that long history has led us to a point where we've been able to introduce personal health budgets, and our intention now is to really start to expand that opportunity for many more people.
So that period of trialing them was obviously key to actually giving a basis to go forward, So can you just give us an idea of the extent of the trials, what was done and the exact findings?
Yeah, there was a controlled trial. So it was a clinically led controlled trial. There was around 1,000 people that were personal health budget recipients that were assessed, and a number of people in the control group who weren't receiving personal health budgets. And the experiences that they had were compared. And the control group provided that benchmarking for us to see what sort of impact. And consequently, you know, the findings of the report, which is an independent academic-based report, was that it was very significant that the people that were receiving personal health budgets were able to find new and innovative ways to support their care and support. They were able to structure plans in a way that best suited their individual need, and consequently there were some really interesting models that emerged from that, and government then had the confidence to take that learning and introduce then a legal right to have for people receiving continuing healthcare funding in 2014, which was the manifestation of all of that work. And based on that work and based on the growing learning and experience that we're taking from cases now that are receiving their support through personal health budgets, we're now rapidly rolling out and scaling them up. So we have some big ambitions over the next few years. We've established within the mandate a commitment to deliver between 50 and 100,000 personal health budgets by 2020.
I hear that.
And this year we're aiming to get 20,000 people onto a personal health budget. So some significant changes.
Well, there's a kind of obvious side to when you look at the idea of somebody being creative about their own solutions to their own problems. There's something obvious about it, but it's been a massive turnaround in a large system that's been providing care up to then, to actually put the locus of choice there right in the patient's hands to allow them to do that. It's been a massive thing to turn around, isn't it?
It is, and you know, the thing is, it's not right for all circumstances.
If
somebody has the unfortunate situation of being knocked down in the street by a car, they don't really want the paramedic leaning over them saying, you know, what matters to you at this moment, you know, what's important for you to achieve in your ambitions for life. They want the NHS to pick them up and support them in the way that it's done for many years. But somebody who has a long-term condition that is an expert in that condition, you know, and this isn't an agenda that's about removing clinical expertise. I mean, that's still incredibly important. Clinicians will always be the expert in the disease or the condition, but people are the experts in themselves. And that clinician, no matter how good he or she is, he's never going to fully understand the experiences of that person that's living with that long-term condition or that particular disease. and consequently trying to harness a different relationship, trying to get a partnership of those two individuals to structure a support plan that works well for that individual, I think is incredibly powerful. And one of the things that I always say that is the shift where personal budgets are concerned is that they enable a shift from somebody being a passive recipient of services done to, mm-hmm. to being an active participant in their health and care. And actually, you know, the health service needs that. We need people to unlock the personal assets that they have and also the assets that are in their family and communities in order to support them as individuals and support the system as well. So bringing together all of those things, I think, is quite important. And it creates some quite beautiful situations where people's lives are transformed astonishingly from how they were having to live, and that's what we're trying to achieve for many more people.
Great. It was very heartening to hear you talking about empowering people in this way. I mean, that's how we act as a charity. We're trying to empower people to make those choices for themselves, to decide the way they want to go forward, and the effect upon them psychologically only, if you only just look at that area, is enormous. To actually empower them in that way and move them from being passive recipients of care, which they might even not think was that great, you know. And so it's a huge turnaround, and as you say, it makes complete sense given the sort of financial burden of giving care that we've always done traditionally.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, empowerment is a key part of this. We want people to be able to have the confidence to manage their lives in a way that is right for them. And I think one of the things that personal health budgets bring is that opportunity of building people's confidence, activating them, and consequently what we tend to find is that not only their personal well-being improves, but their health outcomes tend to improve. And we find as well that there's a win for the system, because it's cost effective for the system.
Excellent. And on the matter you were talking about, the suitability of PHBs, would it be fair to say that it quite neatly divides between acute care and chronic care, that in reality that's the division? Obviously there's no place for it in acute medicine, and acute medicine actually works really well in the NHS anyway. This is actually providing new solutions in an area that is struggling, which is chronic disease.
Absolutely, that's right. I mean, this isn't about deconstructing the things in the NHS that work incredibly well, and you know that there's some absolutely fantastic skills and experiences and knowledge in the NHS that supports people in an acute care setting. I think personal health budgets have a role to play prior to and after acute care. That's really where they come in. Personal health budgets, you know, we've got a lot of evidence of them preventing crisis, of them reducing demand on A&E and on other statutory services as a consequence of much more proactive community-based support going in. And they also have a role to play in reablement, in helping people move from hospital back into a home environment, and getting back into a normal life that is normal for them and right for them after discharge from hospital. So they play a key role both sides. But actually, that hospital environment, that fantastic machinery that happens and supports people is still, you know, the best way that we've got to do things.
Okay, so the Daily Mail might like to characterise PHBs as writing out blank cheques for the nation's scroungers to go out and live it up, but I imagine it's a bit more measured than that. In fact, if you want to give us an outline of how the funding actually works.
Well, I mean, first and foremost, there's no blank cheques. I mean, all personal health budgets are carefully worked out by a clinician and commissioner and the individual. It's not about creating or finding new money from the NHS. It's about using existing resources in a way that better suits that model of care. And, you know, the controversy that surrounds it, I feel, is down to a lack of understanding around what is actually happening for those individuals. I mean, there's a sort of surface level view that views that somebody spending money on X or Y isn't appropriate spend for the NHS. But when you look beneath that, You look at how those small elements of money are improving that individual's life and reducing demand on other NHS services. You realise that actually it's something that we should all be embracing. That, you know, the fact is that services that are commissioned for people in a normal setting within the NHS, in block contracts, in sort of big contracts where you'll have major service providers providing community-based support, if those services aren't meeting the needs of the individuals that they're there to support, then that's not a good use of NHS services. So for us, what I think personal health budgets bring is something that I refer to as precision commissioning. It brings a real a precise opportunity to target all of the available resources that would have ordinarily been spent on that individual anyway, but target them in a way that gets best value for money, because that individual is able, with the clinician, with the commissioner, to structure a package of support where every penny that's going into that counts, and it counts on something that's meeting their health and wellbeing outcomes directly. So it's all part of a plan, it's not a blank check, it's well thought through, it's clinically, there's clinical engagement, there's individuals involved. I think the other thing to say on that is that, you know, the things that will grab headlines are these sort of innovative areas of spending that people sometimes look at. But, you know, the vast majority of money that people spend through their personal health budget goes on basic human rights support, care and support. It goes on people having support to wash and to eat and to have somebody to change a ventilator tube or to change a peg feed. You know, this isn't about luxury items. It's not a luxury to be able to breathe and be able to eat and be able to be clean and go to the toilet. And you know, these are the fundamental things that personal health budgets aim to support. And yes, we want to support social inclusion. We want to support people into work. We want to support people to achieve the ambitions that they've got for life. And that may require some creativity in how we do that. But fundamentally, you know, the spend on personal health budgets is about the things that you and I would say, you know, that is absolute necessity for that individual.
Yeah. Excellent. So despite having free healthcare, the UK public spend on complementary medicine runs into the billions per year. So the public clearly want it as part of their healthcare, particularly when they're managing chronic conditions, in fact. PHBs are aimed at people with chronic conditions, as we've just agreed. Can they spend their money on complementary medicine, despite complementary medicine itself having little to do with some of the cornerstones of the NHS, such as NICE guidelines and evidence-based medicine?
So it isn't a yes and no answer, this one. The reality is that there are PHBs being used on complementary therapies that have been agreed at a local level, where you know, clinical engagement or perhaps other pathways have exhausted conventional means, and consequently an individual and the clinician decide that trying a different approach is going to be a good thing for them and for their health and well-being. So on occasion complementary medicines and therapies are funded, but there are restrictions in what personal health budgets can be used to pay for. There's restrictions, you can't use it for prescription medicine, you can't use it for things that would be deemed to be unsafe, and we do follow NICE guidance. You know, most commissioners would follow NICE guidance in relation to what should be used to support individuals. But actually, what we don't want to do is take away the level of innovation that really creates some good opportunities for people. So people do look at the use of assistive technology, for example. So rather than relying on a personal assistant to come in during the evening, people will opt for telehealth systems. People will also use technology to open blinds and curtains and switch lights on in their house, rather than having PAs do that at 5 o'clock at night, where it's perhaps not convenient. So there are innovative things that, you know, that the NHS doesn't prescribe on a day-to-day basis for people that will be purchased through a personal health budget. But it's quite a tricky answer to say without looking at individual cases, because I think this goes back to, you know, that individual conversation that happens between a clinician and between the individual person to really structure a package of support that's going to be best for them and for the system.
Mm. Okay. So in the early days of PHBs, there was a handy ring fence around the people who were eligible, which was these are people who have been designated as needing continuing healthcare. And that was a pre-existing ring fence, if you like, mm-hmm. already existed. So things have moved on a bit now. Can you tell us who is eligible for a PHB now?
So in terms of eligibility for PHBs, that's still determined by and large at a local level. So each CCG should have a policy approach to who they will support, what groups they're targeting in relation to personal health budgets. But from a national perspective, we are rapidly expanding the number of groups that personal health budgets can benefit. And we've got a number of programs across the country where we're trialling lots of different approaches. So we have a number of complementary programs called Integrated Personal Commissioning, where we're working across health and social care and education, working in conjunction with the local government association to find new and innovative ways to support people at a local level, and personal health budgets are part of that program. We've also got a number of test sites across the country that are trialling specific areas. So you're right, personal health budgets started really targeting people who were in receipt of continuing healthcare. And I mentioned earlier that people since 2014 in receipt of continuing healthcare have had a legal right to a personal health budget. And that's quite a strong commitment from government. We're seeing now many areas in the country starting to use personal health budgets as a mainstream delivery method for continuing healthcare funding, and in some areas they're even moving to personal health budgets being the default delivery method for continuing healthcare. However, beyond that, we are trialling personal health budgets to support people at the end of life. Some great evidence emerging in Warrington, for example, where we've worked with a number of people who are facing their end of life and are on a palliative care pathway. And those individuals have been given personal health budgets. And what we found in that trial is that 83% of those recipients have been enabled to die in their place of choice. And that's against an average of 26% dying in their place of choice.
A complete turnaround.
Yeah, and also within that, not only the outcome, obviously, for the individual that the individual wanted, but 1 week's worth of conventional services is funding 6 weeks worth of the personal health budget across those cases as well.
Wow.
And 100% of people have chosen to have a care and support package that wasn't previously being offered. So quite revolutionary things that are happening there. We're also trying personal health budgets to support people with a learning disability, and part of our Transforming Care program to reduce the number of people that are staying in institutionalised care, enabling people to move back into the community, and personal health budgets are a big part to play in there. We've got areas trying personal health budgets for mental health. We've got areas looking at personal health budgets to replace wheelchair voucher schemes with personal health budgets to give wheelchair users more choice and control over the equipment. We're looking at lots of trials for wider groups of people with long-term conditions, living with chronic illness or living with various impairments and for other groups of disabled people. We're looking at personal health budgets for children and looked after young people as well, young people in transition, care leavers. So there's a growing list of the areas that we want to target, because you know this isn't a small-scale piloting programme. This is a change to the way in which the NHS fundamentally delivers care and support for people, and a change to the way in which community services are deployed. And over the next few years, we'll significantly expand those groups. We've even recently, last year, we've launched personal maternity care budgets, which is a close relative of the personal health budgets, where we're enabling women to have greater choice and control over their maternity care through having a personal health budget to choose the birth pathway that is right for them. And we've actually now got over 1,000 women that have experienced a personal maternity budget, and we're hoping to grow that number over the next few months, so that we have 10,000 women this year experiencing that level of choice and control.
And with people like these 1,000 women, are you collecting data on their response to the service?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the programme, which is our Maternity Pioneers programme, came out as part of the Better Births review that Baroness Julia Cumberledge undertook. And what that found is that women are not always getting choice and control over the four birth pathways that are available. So women have a choice generally of being able to give birth in an obstetric unit, in a midwife-led unit that's either standalone or alongside an obstetric unit, so that there's either standalone or outside being two options, mm-hmm. or home births. Mm-hmm. And actually many women that were surveyed in the Better Births review said that they wanted a home birth. I think it was around 78% of women that said they wanted a home birth. And our home birth rate in this country is less than 3%. So a big gap there in terms of meeting the choice and control that women actually want in maternity services. And what we're hoping to measure through personal maternity budgets is that the choices that women make will be much more enabled as a consequence of them having control over that decision making and where that funding is given to the system. Mm.
And in terms of, like, I go down to my local, the offering is going to be different in different areas, basically, as to what is being supported with the personal health budget. Am I entitled to ask for the personal health budget for something that's not on the list?
Absolutely. I think everybody should, you know, if they've got a good proposition to the system, talking to their local service around how they think their care and support could be structured in a different way that benefits both them and the system, is a really good conversation to have. Mm. And you know, the there will be a different approach regionally, and you know, the NHS through clinical commissioning groups is structured regionally so that people at that regional level can best meet the needs of the populations. They're working in those community groups and they can understand those needs of the populations, but actually having that conversation around areas of support that could be tweaked, that could be improved, and personal health budgets being a catalyst for that, I think is a really, really good approach. And we've seen lots of people using personal health budgets in innovative ways more recently to tackle very localised issues that are faced. And we've got some trials at the moment where we're looking at supporting people who are suffering from substance misuse and trying to use a personalised approach and an integrated approach to care and support to support them. So that's come about as local people have said, actually, we could do something differently in this area.
Well, you get this real sense of kind of unleashing some creativity that simply didn't have any room to breathe before. Okay, key question now. Yes, Life has supported people with cancer. So, cancer is increasingly being viewed now as a chronic disease rather than an acute condition. And certainly at Yes, Life, we've helped many people to stay well for years with cancer. Integrative medicine's got much to offer in this respect. So, listeners to this show will be wanting to know if and when PHBs might become available to them to help them to manage their condition. Many of the intrepid survivors, they've had to carry the cost of their unconventional treatment as well as the disease itself up to now.
Well, I mean, we're fortunate for advancements and healthcare in this country with some of the best cancer outcomes in the world, and the cancer strategy is focused on continuing to make improvements and continuing to transform lives, and it's fantastic that people are surviving cancer and are living longer and healthier lives as you know, post their illness, and but what we find, as you say, is that people are living longer with more chronic conditions, and consequently they need ongoing care and support. And the work that we're doing for people with all long-term conditions, I think, really supports the group that you've outlined. The group that actually, you know, without a level of ongoing care and support, without a level of community-based support, they would be having episodes that required them to seek further support from their GP or further support from secondary care. And what we need to do is find ways that those groups can be supported in order to reduce demand on those services and improve their outcomes, because nobody wants to go to A&E because they've got a crisis of managing their condition. So people who are survivors of cancer that are living with long-term conditions, I think, you know, at the moment, unfortunately, there's no major models that are out there in relation to personal health budgets for cancer survivors. However, the cancer strategy that NHS England is delivering seeks to look at how we can more effectively personalise aftercare for cancer survivors, and we're doing work on long-term conditions, and hopefully over time, as we start to grow the number of people routinely receiving personal health budgets as part of their care and support, we can further expand the groups. And certainly, you know, I'm passionate about helping groups of people that are really struggling with a system that perhaps, you know, needs to shift slightly to better support their needs. And it's something that I'm keen to look at. So there's no solution at the moment, but as we grow the number of people on a personal health budget, I think there's an opportunity for people who are survivors of cancer to look at ways in which they could embrace the same model.
So it's increasingly becoming a more normal model to support people, the PHBs, obviously, as the numbers go up. And so is there a role for the public in demand?
Well, the issue of numbers is a really interesting one. So around 2 years ago, we had very low number of people. There was only around sort of 3,500 people that were receiving a personal health budget. At the end of March of this year, there were just under 16,000 people receiving a personal health budget, which was an exponential increase in the numbers. But 16,000 people in a country with a population that we've got is still a small number. So we're not where we want to be. And the aim over the next few years is to rapidly increase the numbers. And I think that comes from a number of areas. I think that's from the system actually recognising that personalisation and personal health budgets are one of the key factors that's going to support the NHS becoming sustainable. So it's a key way of improving health and wellbeing outcomes, but it's also a way of reducing demand and saving money. And we find, you know, for example, in continuing healthcare funding, and the work that we've done to date shows that there's an average of 11 to 15% saving on the costs of a personal health budget against a conventional service
model.
That's
enormous, isn't it? 11 to 15%, you translate that out to the number of chronic conditions in this country, it's massive.
Absolutely. So you know, there's a huge opportunity for commissioners and for the service to embrace personal health budgets. So we hope demand's going to come from there, by people, you know, embracing that this is a key tool to support the way in which the NHS needs to continue to evolve and transform. We also hope that people will embrace the opportunity that brings for them and their families. And as more and more people begin receiving a personal health budget, we've got more and more case studies that are on our website that demonstrate just the impact that that's had on people's lives. We're working with a large team of peer leaders, which is really important. Co-production's been an inherent part of the personalisation journey for the NHS. And we have a number of employed peer leaders who are previous recipients or have had family members who are recipients of personal health budgets that are helping go out to community groups and talk to them about their experiences. And we've got a peer leadership academy and a strategic co-production group that actually works with people who have received personal health budgets or are living with long-term conditions and enables them to talk to the community groups as well. So we're hoping through that movement we can grow a social movement of people wanting to take more choice and control, and then that will hopefully meet commissioners wanting to provide it. So, you know, getting those two things right is an interesting balance. But I think if we do grow more demand from individuals, and we do grow more demand from the system, that could really, really help us shape the numbers that we are wanting to achieve.
Right. Well, that saving obviously will be a big carrot for the commissioners, won't it? As that becomes more and more an established fact that this is a way to save money, then they're going to hopefully be a lot more open to them than they might be at the start.
Absolutely. And I think the really magical thing with the savings is that it's not because people are using personal health budgets to make savings. The magical thing is that it's an indirect product of a personalised approach. So the reason that those savings generally occur are that because that person-centred care planning has taken place, because that individual is that active participant that I spoke about earlier, what you find is that firstly they're able to buy similar things but more cost effectively. So they're perhaps able to employ a personal assistant to provide them with care that's cheaper than a care agency. Secondly, they're able to buy different things, some of those innovations that I've talked about, assistive technology and equipment, or different forms of support. They're able to buy different things that achieve the same outcome. But thirdly, because they are in control of that budget, actually people, you and I don't know how well you budget, but you know, generally speaking, people are quite prudent with their own money and will take take responsibility for how that cash is used. And that the same is true with personal health budgets. So people use that money very, very wisely. So the sort of notion of a blank check and people just having this money and you know, abusing the NHS as a consequence, that isn't borne out in any of the evidence. You know, people in this country quite rightly hold the NHS very dear to their hearts. And when people have a personal health budget, I think they have a real inherent sense of how important it is for them to spend that money wisely in a way that suits them. And consequently, you get the savings. But you don't get them because you're looking for savings. You get them because you're looking to support people in a more effective way. And isn't it great that we save money off the back end of that?
Brilliant, brilliant. So last thing, looking forward, future of personalisation. Where do you think it's going in the next few years?
We've talked about a number of areas, actually, where I think it could expand. I think for me, what we need to begin looking at is beyond personal health budgets, we need to be looking at a more universal system of personalised care. So there are many initiatives that, as Director of Personalised Care in NHS England, I'm looking to increase over the next few years. And what we're doing is we're bringing all of those together in a central model so that the system's got one model of universal personalised care and support. And that model looks at a population health basis, so it's not just for people with very significant needs, it's also for people for one or more long-term conditions, but it's also a whole population approach, because what we've got to do is we've got to bring personalised care further upstream. We've got to prevent people from falling in the river in the first place, rather than just constantly picking them out of the river further downstream. So we've got to bring that care and support more upfront. And there are a number of initiatives that we've got. We've had, I mentioned the Integrated Personal Commissioning Programme. We've got a fantastic programme which is called Empowering People and Communities, where we're bringing together areas at a local level, and we're trialling different things that release community assets and look at supporting people in a more active way. There's a tool that we're rolling out called Patient Activation Measurement, or PAM, which seeks to measure somebody's level of confidence to manage their own health and well-being, and that's using as a tool. There's health coaching, there's social prescribing to look at referring people to community-based support rather than statutory services. So all of these interventions, and personal health budgets being a key part of that, all of these interventions are being brought together in a really, really clear and easy framework for the system to implement. And my team are producing all the resources and providing on-site support to a significant number of places across the country where we're rolling this out at scale now. And more recently, we've just signed up three of the emerging accountable care systems, which were announced recently following the publication of the next steps in the five-year forward view. And accountable care systems are clusters of CCGs who are working together to look at innovative ways to support their populations, and they're going to have more powers and more control from NHS England. And those accountable care systems in Greater Nottingham, Luton Bedford and Milton Keynes and Dorset are going to be working with us to scale personalised care across the whole of their regions. And that's in addition to Greater Manchester, who we're already working with to scale this. So what we'll see in the future is much more holistic, much more integrative models of personalised care scaled on a much larger footprint. And I'm hoping that the personalisation revolution that started in the 1970s and 80s with the independent living movement can really continue at pace now, and many more thousands of people benefiting from personal health budgets is what we're trying to achieve.
Fantastic. Well, look, thank you very much, James, for talking to me today. I must say that everybody I talk to in personalisation is, there's a tangible feeling of excitement about change, and I really feel this is the way it's got to go. I mean, the public's been wanting this for so long, and it's really heartening to hear what you're delivering.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. Yes, it's been really good to have the conversation with you, and I hope your listeners gained from what I've been saying in relation to the model. But there's plenty more information on our website, and lots of resources out there for others. Thank you.
To round out the view of personal health budgets, I've been put in touch with two people who have worked with them for some time. The first is Joe Reeder. Joe is an Integrated Personal Commissioning Programme Lead in Hertfordshire, and in recent years she's been involved in implementing personal health budgets in the county.
Hi Joe, thanks very much indeed for taking the time to talk to us today.
No problem, Robin.
So I've had a great chat with James Sanderson, and he did a brilliant job giving me the overview on personal health budgets, where they come from, where they're going.
So you've been involved for many years down on the front line there implementing these. And firstly, PHBs are now integrated personal commissioning. So I'll put the integrated personal commissioning on the back burner and ask you about that later if I can. But first, can you just tell us what effects personal health budgets are having and how they're changing people's lives?
Certainly. I've worked in personal health budgets in Hertfordshire for over 2 years before I started working on integrated personal commissioning. And what's been fantastic in that journey is really implementing the learning from personal budgets in social care that have been around for a lot longer and actually giving people not only just control over the care that they receive, but the money used to meet those needs. So we're primarily working with people who are eligible for continuing health care, and they're individuals that have very high significant primary health needs, more than what we would expect social care to meet. And it's not been around forever. It was a very new initiative, very difficult for us to put together, but actually really making differences to some of the most complex people with the most significant health needs. And what I've seen is changes from things like people just having what we would take for granted, having the decision about what time of day care would be delivered at home and who would be coming into their home, through to people making really significant decisions to become legal employers of their own carers and having real choice of control over who meets their needs. And what that's enabled people to do, particularly I've worked with a number of people with a working age with spinal injuries who, by taking that step to take control over their care, have felt more in control of their lives and therefore have been able to live independently, look at going back to work or accessing education. I've also seen the benefits to people being able to choose where they would like their lives to end. For people that have been under palliative care, really having that choice of being able to choose to die at home surrounded by the people that they want to be there. And also, one of the emerging things that's come up, the work that I was doing, is the real benefit that it has to informal carers of people with complex health needs. The benefit to know, for the carers to be truly in control of that care, to know exactly how their loved ones' needs are going to be met, and then being able to have that space to look after their own health as well. And that was one of the really striking things about working on that programme for the years that I was working on it.
Right. Well, James did mention this end-of-life situation. I mean, it's one of the scandals that, you know, everybody wants to die at home and almost nobody does. But he gave a fantastic figure as to the proportion he'd managed to achieve under personal health budgets.
And it's one of those things, because as part of personal health budgets, it's not just us handing over money to people. It's very well planned with the person and their carers and their health team. But what we're doing is, unlike things like other advanced care planning, we're attaching funds to the planning. We're enabling things to happen because then people can react in emergencies. We do things like having contingency plans within that plan to do as much as we can to meet those people's needs. Unfortunately, some people, due to circumstances, may not get to be at home, but for the majority, we've been able to make it work because they've had that, again, that consistent staff team who know the person's wishes. And for one lady we worked with, it was very important for her to have her dog at her home when she passed away. And we managed to make that happen by having a team of carers who knew that was the most important thing to her.
Amazing. Okay, so now I just want to go on to the integrated personal commissioning. I didn't go into this with James. It's primarily the health side that I wanted to focus on in this show. But IPC is another enormously important development, as it provides an almost instant fix to that intransigent problem of joining up health and social care. This is something that's dogged successive governments for decades. And of course, many of the people who are dealing with chronic conditions do have a whole range of needs that fall outside of healthcare. So can you explain the principle of IPC?
I certainly can. So Hertfordshire, we bid to become an integrated personal commissioning site. I'm sure James talks about this being the direction of the NHS going forward, but a number of areas bid to apply to become a site in Hertfordshire was one of them. And the reason why we did that is it builds on everything that we already want to do, which, as you said, is that getting together of health and social care and everyone working together. And for me, the real strength of the Integrated Personal Commissioning Programme is the real focus on the people. It's all very focused on the experience of individuals, of having, we talk about integration a lot, but actually this is about people feeling like they are receiving an integrated service, to having one care and support plan, if we're talking about personal health budgets, having them integrated with social care, because as you said, people will cross over health and social care. So there's that focus on well-being rather than health or social care. Mm-hmm. We're also doing a lot of work to widen the responsibility. So it's about people being more proactive in managing their own care and their own health and not instantly going to services. And then people that are needing services because they've got more complex needs, of understanding their role in navigating the system and having the resources to do it. Also, the big strength of the Integrated Personal Commissioning Programme for us in Hertfordshire is that it's signed up to at quite a high level across. We have two CCGs in Hertfordshire and a large county council. And at a high level, we're all committed to making the Integrated Personal Commissioning Programme work. So what we've got is a very high level sign up to making IPC a reality. And we're working with people in the community so that they know their role as well. And the biggest and most difficult part, and then we haven't cracked it just yet, is then about releasing money. So we talk about people having personal health budgets and having more control of the money. And at the moment, that's only really available in continuing healthcare. It's about us working with our existing contracts, our large monolith block contracts in health, to try and see where we can offer more choice and control. There might be areas where we can offer people true money and choice. But for us, it's about making sure that the way we commission is personalised, is that people know what's available and why things have been made, and that they've got some choice in how their health needs are met, and that our social care workforce and our health workforce are working better together.
Well, it has enabled you to kind of get round this issue of getting these two gargantuan organisations to turn into one. That's what's been tried by government for years, isn't it? And of course, the chances were that one mega gargantuan organisation would probably have bigger flaws than the two separate ones, and generate more problems for individuals. But by very cleverly putting the individual at the centre of the whole thing, and they pick and choose from one place or another, it actually obviates the whole need to do that.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's the principle of this, and we've seen it work to a micro way with, for example, with our wheelchair service and working with our provider and people having the option to either have what the wheelchair service could provide or taking their money and purchasing a wheelchair elsewhere, which gives people that true choice and control. And people will, first of all, vote with their feet. If something isn't being provided that they want, then they'll have the option to go elsewhere. But also, for me, the real power of this is actually our providers. They need to work better if they want to keep people coming to them as well.
Right.
So it's that dual role there, which I think that commissioning in a personalised way, an outcome-based way, and if people aren't delivering what people want, then people will have the choice to go elsewhere.
So it won't be good enough to just deliver the same old service that's had flaws all along. Great. Well,
absolutely.
Look, it's been brilliant to talk to you today, Jo. There's I'm saying to James, there's a tangible excitement amongst all the people working in this area about really bringing some change that's actually helping people on the ground. And I can hear it in you as well.
I'm very passionate about this, and I do think we can make it work. I really do.
All right. Thank you very much, Jo.
No problem. It's really nice to speak with you.
Now I can speak to Colin Royal, who is a lived experience IPC advisor, which means that he provides input to developing services from the perspective of the people who are receiving them. Hi Colin, I appreciate you giving your time today to share your experience about IPCs.
Hi, really lovely to meet you.
Great, so the reason you have your role today as an IPC advisor is your personal experience on the ground of supporting your father Malcolm, I understand, from 2009 to 2015. Could you tell us what was your father dealing with at the time, and what effect did having an IPC have on the course of his care?
Yeah, so my dad suffered from early onset dementia. It was a rare form of dementia, right frontal lobe, which meant that his needs were both very complex and quite unusual. So he originally came out of hospital having been in the section in 2008, and the actual care packages that were in place for him weren't really suitable for him and didn't really meet his needs. So there were quite limited options, and what it ultimately meant was that he had to receive care outside of his own home, which is the place where he felt safest. So
right.
we looked at getting a personal health budget, which kind of proved to be incredibly successful for him and enabled him to employ staff for himself, which actually worked consistently with him and really got to understand his needs and really improve the quality of his life and work around him. So it became very kind of person-centered and worked for him in times of that he could do the activities that he most wanted to do and live the life that he wanted to live and ultimately stay living at home.
Fantastic. So he started with a personal health budget, but this became integrated personal commissioning over time, yeah, where it broadened out beyond just healthcare.
So it didn't actually, no. So,
no, it didn't.
So
right.
His,
okay.
His budget was, it was a mixed budget. So it had funding from both health and social care because it was under a section 117. But it wasn't actually an integrated personal commissioning budget. So okay. The integrated personal commissioning program has been running since 2014. So this kind of predates
this is
that.
This
really.
too new for him. I see. But he had a personal health budget, which allowed him to spend some of that budget on social care.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess as part of the broader program of integrated personal commissioning, personal health budgets are a part of that. So my dad had quite an early experience of having a personal health budget, but it was to meet all of his life needs, really. So it wasn't just for a kind of health tasks and health outcomes. It was to meet his whole life. And I guess that was explored through having a really good care planning conversation, just thinking about what was working well for him, what wasn't, and the best ways to kind of keep him safe and well within all of that as well, and meeting, fulfilling the life that he most wanted. So that's what it really enabled him to do.
Mm-hmm. So you're a lived experience advisor. On the basis of what you've experienced with your father, you're actually advising services going forward.
Kind of, yeah. So now, yeah, I'm working with NHS England as a lived experience advisor. So this is very much a role that helps to hold the programme to account and keep things what we describe as true to purpose. So we work with different sites who are involved with the Integrated Personal Commissioning programme to do co-production. So it's essentially bringing what is designed in policy at quite a high level into practice to make sure that it actually fulfills what it is that the programme is trying to achieve for people in their real lives, ultimately. So so it's making sure that kind of key decision makers are working alongside people who are going through the process and have that lived experience to have that shared vision of how this should be co-designed and co-developed and implemented as well.
Excellent. Well, it's really good to hear that's happening in that way, because that's the only way you get the services that people really need. Would you like to sum up how important you think the personal health budget and IPC initiatives are in changing the way that we deliver health and social care?
Absolutely. So the personal health budget and integrated personal commissioning programs feel really essential to developing what it is that we're trying to do in terms of person-centered approaches. So we've currently got a system that has worked really well for some people and less well for others. And I think by making services more integrated around the person really helps to ensure that each individual gets the best possible experience and kind of keeps that consistency. I think it's also better from a system point of view. It's because it's about having a more proactive approach, and instead of waiting until people become so unwell and then trying to introduce health and social care, it's actually ensuring people stay well and live a good quality of life and do that within the community as well and staying living at home as well. And it feels really important to keep seeing people as people rather than simply kind of numbers or figures within a healthcare system.
Mm-hmm. So it's a real win-win, really, because it is delivering more health to the people who are on these schemes, but also it actually works much better for the country as a whole.
That's very true. So there's accumulating evidence to show that there are broader benefits to the system, which is in terms of people having reduced hospital admissions and need for frontline services such as GP appointments. Certainly in the experience of my own dad, his medication reduced by 2/3. He only ever had one hospital appearance within 5 years. And also the evidence suggests that more and more people are benefiting from this. But yeah, huge benefits to people as well in terms of they get to stay living at home and they get to actually have services integrated around their life. And And one quote is that they actually have a life rather than a service, which feels really important to people.
Right. All right. Well, look, really heartening to hear your experience of how they've actually helped your dad. Thanks a lot for sharing it with us, Colin.
Thanks very much for that. Thank you.
I hope I've given you some insight into why I'm so excited about PHBs and their potential to open up genuine choice in cancer care, a field in which at present there is pretty much none whatsoever. I hope to revisit the subject again in the not too distant future to bring you up to date with progress, so watch this space. As usual, links to material relevant to today's show are on the Yes to Life website, that's yestolife.org.uk, and you'll find a link to the show on the homepage. A reminder to secure your place at the Yes to Life annual conference on the 25th of November. If you're quick, you can still get an early bird discount. Click the link again on the homepage of the Yes to Life website, yestolife.org.uk, to read about the stellar lineup of speakers and to book your ticket. Do join me again next week for another Yes to Life show. Goodbye.